Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things everyone's passionate about but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics, where we investigate the evidence to help you decide what you think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life, questions about God and eternity, reason and faith, meaning and purpose.
And also mission. What is our mission? Rick, you're a business guy. You built a business with a mission. How would you describe that mission?
I would describe the experience as hope, on occasion, a house divided. I mean, it's hard,
yeah.
You know, because capitalism seems to sometimes call you in one direction and the sense of mission in another.
Uh-huh. Well, today we're interviewing a business guy who built a business with a mission to become the next Walt Disney, but a Disney with a distinctly Christian identity and message. Phil Vischer is the creator of VeggieTales, which has sold over 50 million videos and is launching its second major movie in theaters January 11th. But our guest no longer steers the company. It fell into bankruptcy, and Phil has chronicled the rise and fall of his dream company, Big Idea, in his book, Me, Myself, and Bob. And today, we'll talk to him about his intense struggle to build a new media empire for God, and then the heartbreak of its tremendous fall. And we'll discuss the questions he shouted at God and the answers he has discovered on his journey to rebuild his life and mission as he sees or seeks evidence for God on his journey. Phil Vischer is a writer, an actor, an animator, a puppeteer, the co-founder of Big Ideas Production, the company best known for bringing VeggieTales to the screens of our TVs and our movie theaters and computers. Today, Phil's faith-filled stories can be found in a third of all American homes with young children. Phil is since starting a new creative shop called Jellyfish Labs, where he's actively pursuing new ways to integrate faith and storytelling, including the release of three books, Sydney and Norman, 47 Beavers in the Big Blue Sea, and the one we'll discuss today, Me, Myself, and Bob, his own story.
Well, Phil, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Hey, Phil, you created Bob the Tomato, Larry the Cucumber, all the Veggie Pals, and you wrote the script for the big new VeggieTales movie coming to theaters in January. I think it's the 11th. The Pirates.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the Pirates Who Don't Do Anything. And I'm wondering...
The Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, yeah. Sounds
how hard,
exciting, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, how hard could it have been to write a story about vegetables that don't do anything? I mean, like, do you really get paid for that kind of work?
Yeah, well, to come up with, you know, 80, 90 pages of nothing is not as easy as it sounds. Just ask Jerry Seinfeld, who had to do that on a weekly basis for his TV show.
Yeah. And so...
No, what it really is, it started with, we had these really popular characters, the Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, that have been around in VeggieTales kind of mythology for... Oh, 7 or 8 years, mm-hmm. And they had supporting roles in our first movie, Jonah, and it was so much fun working with them in that film that we decided, well, gee, maybe they need their own little piratey adventure,
mm-hmm.
You know, which immediately led to the issue, but wait a minute, they're the Pirates Who Don't Do Anything, so what could their goal be? You know, they're slackers, they don't have goals. And so I kind of had to go back and rework them a little bit, and we came up with a really fun premise that actually they're wannabe heroes. You know,
mm-hmm.
they want to be the stars, they want to be in the spotlight, they want to be on the stage, but they just can't. They're kind of overcome with their own weaknesses, and they can't take the chance, you know, to do something big. So they're fake pirates. But they're not even good fake pirates. They're working in a pirate-themed dinner theater, you know, kind of like a something you'd find in Orlando or
uh-huh.
Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And not only are they not in the main show, they're busboys. They're called cabin boys, and they refill drinks and bus tables because they're just too wimpy or too chicken or too, you know, cowardly to actually try out for the big show. And what the whole film is about really is it's kind of like a parable about being a hero. You know,
mm-hmm.
what does it take to be a hero, and what makes a real hero? And then what does it have to do with, you know, God calling us to do big things? How does that work? So it's got a spiritual lesson under it. Which is a really interesting way to communicate, you know, a spiritual lesson in the form of what looks just like a really silly movie.
Yeah, and it sounds great, and I've heard great buzz about it, and we're looking forward to it coming out. And hey, speaking of great dreams and a great calling, we want to focus our interview today on your book, Me, Myself, and God, a true story about dreams, God, and talking vegetables. And you begin your story talking about your childhood dreams and your heritage. You grew up in a Christian home. Your mother grew up in a Christian home, lots of church. You said no movies or cards except Rook. And I was really wondering, why do you think Rook was allowed?
Because it wasn't a deck of playing cards that, you know, had the heritage of gambling and saloons and, you know, all the seedy, you know, Las Vegas implications of playing cards.
Right.
So my family on both sides is Christian, going back at least four generations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get back to generations that were fairly legalistic about how we should be separate from the world. And my father could not see movies. My mother could see movies, but could not do any work on Sunday, could not even swim or really play on Sunday.
Yeah.
Neither of them could play with playing cards. You know,
mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of strictness that came out, much of it around the turn of the century in the Christian community here in the U.S. And so it was interesting to kind of grow up in that heritage, a fairly strict heritage. But at the same time, my great-grandfather on my mother's side was one of the first radio preachers in the country who went on the radio in 1923, the year after radio was commercialized in the U.S.
Yeah.
And he preached every Sunday morning on the radio until he died in 1963. And then, in fact, his radio show continued until 1978, at which point it was the oldest, longest-running radio show in the country.
Mm-hmm. And so
I grew up with this really interesting heritage, kind of, you know, a religious, almost showbiz heritage.
Yeah.
You know, my mom growing up live on live radio, playing the piano when she was 5 years old on the radio, accompanying her little brother who was singing his first solo at the age three. her aunt was actually named by the radio audience. They had a contest to write in and name our new daughter. And my great aunt Jean was named by radio listeners way, way back in the 1930s.
Wow. And so, how did you feel as a little guy growing up in a home with that kind of a Christian heritage? How did you feel about that heritage?
Well, I liked the heritage because I you know, bumped into so many people in the Midwest that knew my great-grandpa or knew my grandpa who had taken over the ministry, you know, had heard of us. So it made me feel special. You know, like, hey, I'm somebody special. I'm part of this illustrious heritage. At the same time, it also gave me a very strong impression that big things were expected, you know, of us.
Uh-huh.
That I couldn't just slough off. I couldn't be a pirate who doesn't do anything. You know, that I had to get busy and really accomplish things. And that's what God wanted from me. You know, He wanted to see how much I could do and how quickly I could do it.
Right.
And so I grew up with this drive, kind of an inherited drive, that, you know, I had to hit the ground running and see what I could accomplish, see what I could do. I couldn't sit around.
Yeah.
And that, you know, led me going to Bible college and then looking
at
film school.
Okay, well, let's not get ahead of the story here, okay?
Okay, where are we?
You wrote that early in your life you noticed that your brain was weird. And, and when I read that in your book, I thought, gosh, you must have been very self-aware because I think I was in my early 20s before I realized how weird my brain was.
Yeah,
so what do you mean? What do you mean by you realized your brain was weird?
Well, I would observe something and comment on it, and the people around me would laugh at the comment. And it struck me that they must not be looking at things quite the same way I was looking at things. That there was something about my brain that just made me look at things kind of weird. And when I would comment about what I saw, that other people found it amusing. And I realized that they, at least in their eyes, considered me to be funny.
It reminds me of someone
asked
Gary Larson, who wrote, the cartoonist who wrote The Far Side, and they said, you know, where did you get such a weird sense of humor? And he said, what's weird about it?
Right. You don't really know that it's different until people tell you.
Yeah.
You know, that's really different. That's really weird.
And then at age 8, your dad walked out on your family. How did that impact your life, and especially your faith in God?
That was kind of a big thing because he was the creative one in our mm-hmm. family. He was mm-hmm. It's where my sense of humor comes from, my father and from his mother. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was just very dry and very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad was an advertising executive and a storyteller and shot TV commercials for his clients, the tire company that he worked in, the tire industry, and mm-hmm. went to Baja, California, and was shooting tire commercials and doing all these amazingly cool things. And I just worshiped the guy. But there was something that just fundamentally wasn't working, you know, at home between my mom and my dad. And, you know, I didn't really see it coming no one told me to expect things to fall apart. But I was, I think I was 9 years old, and he came down the stairs one day and kissed me on the forehead and walked out the door. And it just about, you know, ended my life. I just thought, I don't even want to be here.
Now, how did that impact your faith in God?
At that age, it really didn't impact my faith that much because mm-hmm. I think even at that age, it was clear to me that my dad had made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and perhaps if he'd been struck by lightning or, you know, eaten by a shark,
uh-huh.
I might have said,
yeah.
God, why did you let that happen?
Yeah.
But I very clearly saw, you know, my dad walk away. So I don't think I ever thought, you know, why did you do that, God? But I definitely thought, you know, Dad, why did you leave? And that was pretty hard because to a certain extent, it's easier to have your father taken from you, where you can be mad at other people, you know, a drunk driver or a shark,
yeah.
Than it is to see your father look at you and then choose to leave, because that sends you a message about yourself,
right?
You know, that just, well, maybe I'm not worth staying around for.
And so you write that you kind of retired to the basement a lot, built things, watched TV. You may be one of the few people in the world, Fear, who decided on your life's purpose while watching Dire Straits and Peter Gabriel 1980s music videos on MTV. And so I thought it'd be fun for you to tell our audience about your great MTV epiphany.
Yeah, it was, I was a shy kid to start out with, and when my dad left, I became even more introverted,
mm-hmm.
and his office was in the basement, and so once that was empty, I'd been sharing a room with my brother, and I just moved down into the basement, you know, into my dad's old office,
mm-hmm.
and I experimented with film cameras and drawing and, you know, listening mm-hmm. to music down there, and really kind of had more of an internal life, much less an external life. You know,
mm-hmm.
didn't do stuff with sports or friends or, you know, go to school that much, or school activities. I was really living, you know, in the ideas in my head. And then when I was a sophomore in high school, by then the divorce had happened. It was all final. And we had moved into to the Chicago area. We grew up originally in Iowa along the Mississippi River. So we moved to the Chicago area, and of course the suburbs in the early 80s were all being wired with cable television.
Mm-hmm.
And cable came through, and MTV turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first year it was on. It was my sophomore year of high school, and I remember sitting at home watching MTV and having two strong reactions. The first one was, this is so cool, because they were doing things with technology and video editing and animation that I'd never seen before on TV. It was kind of like a 24-hour film.
Yeah,
it was like a 24-hour film festival.
Uh-huh.
So I just, that part of it, I just ate up. But my other strong reaction was, this is trouble. Because, you know, even as a sophomore in high school, it was clear to me that the values that were coming across in many of the music videos were not the values I'd learned in Sunday school.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many cases were the exact opposite. And I remember thinking, okay, if everyone my age thinks this is as cool as I think it is, we have a big problem. And it occurred to me at that moment that I wasn't supposed to, you know, protest it. I wasn't supposed to write angry letters about it or,
mm-hmm.
you know, or chain myself to the axle of Madonna's tour bus to protest the morality of her videos, that God had wired me in such a way as to really do something about it, to use my love of technology. I was already programming computers and then
mm-hmm.
playing around with animation. My filmmaking and my storytelling and my sense of humor to take all those things and kind of put them together in a way that could offset the messages that were coming from things like MTV and try to fight for the morality of our kids, you know, against much of what was coming out of Hollywood. And that's, you know, at the age of about 16 is really when I felt that's my purpose.
Yeah, I'm always jealous of those kind of people, you know, like that land their purpose early.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's stop at age 16 and take a break. And then we will come back and we'll pick up from there.
Sure.
And this is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things everyone's passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics. And we'll be back in a minute.
This is Aaron Edwards, pastor of Sundays at Main Street, located at Main Street Crossing in Tomball, and I would like to invite you to come and check us out. We are a diverse community, to say the least, of people, some believers, some not, who believe Jesus Christ when he tells us that whenever we help the poor, the diseased, addicted, and broken down, we are helping him. This may or may not look like a normal church setting. We all get together before our 7 p.m. meeting time and we grill burgers and hot dogs, and this is kind of our way of breaking bread together, if you will. Then we sit around and listen to the great acoustical live music of Matt Davis. We then watch a short film that illustrates the topic of the evening. And we're having great discussions and building authentic relationships with each other, and everyone from every walk of life is welcome to come and join us without feeling judged or rejected. When it comes down to it, I believe that more important than any doctrine or any belief system is Christ's call for us to love him and love each other in the same way that he loves us. And believe me when I say you are loved beyond your wildest dreams.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off because we have three ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes, so without any effort, you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. Three ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening. We're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we bring you evidence to help you decide what you think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life. And we are here with Phil Vischer, the founder and creator of VeggieTales.
And to those that are familiar with him, the voice of Bob the Tomato, right, Phil?
That is correct.
I need to identify just so that any kids riding in the car will know that this is really you.
Hi, kids. I'm Bob the Tomato.
All right.
Here you go.
The authentic Bob the Tomato.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Phil, I personally didn't come to believe the claims of Christianity until I was 30 years old, but I remember I did go to church as a child, and I remember hearing the various Bible stories, and I couldn't help thinking as I was watching the David and Goliath segment of the video that I saw that you did, God Made You Special, and as I was watching that story, I remembered that those stories seemed untrue and even silly to me as a child. So here's my question. Are you a Bible literalist? Do you think that the Bible in every case recounts history as it happened, or do you see these Bible stories as more metaphorical?
Oh, good heavens. I didn't know we had these kinds of questions.
Oh, absolutely. Bushwhacked, ambushed.
Yes, I would fall more into the camp of literalist. I do believe that the more we learn, primarily archaeologically in the last 100-150 years, the more we find that the evidence tends to support that, wow, that may actually have really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some stories like, you know, the Book of Job and a few other things where there's still people say, well, maybe that's more of a story that was told at the time, as opposed to a historical account, and I'm not quite wise enough to weigh in on some of those dicier issues.
Sure.
But overall,
mm-hmm.
Yes, I would definitely fall into the camp that these things actually happened, that there is a God, that if there is a God capable of of creating everything I'm looking at, that he's also capable of occasionally altering the rules of nature so that people can, you know, cross the Red Sea or just do some astonishing and supernatural things. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a problem with that at all.
Well, I think my own response there, Phil, is that if there's a God who is big and beautiful and awesome enough to create the creation that we enjoy every day, then, you know, he did it to want to put us in it and probably have some kind of connection there. And so he's clearly able to have that connection and be a part of his own story if he wants to.
Sure.
Well, absolutely. And I've found that to be true, you know, in my own story,
yeah,
as well, that he has shown up in it. And things have happened that, you know, I cannot explain any other way.
Yeah, we want to get to that in just a minute.
Yeah, well, Phil, we've done about 100 shows so far on this show, The Things That Matter Most, and they're filled with evidence backing up some of these wild stories that you read in the Bible. There's so many to say. One, just quickly, is that you, of course, the Bethlehem Star. And we had a guy on who's a professor at Texas A&M University who got a hold of the NASA software and was able to, which can show what the sky looked like at any given day from any, at any given hour at any point on Earth. And if you go back in, he went back into those periods when the Bethlehem Star was supposed to have shown up, and sure enough, right there was this convergence of certain planets and this retrograde motion, blah, 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 and sure enough, there it was. And it would have looked exactly the way the Bible describes. So that we have lots of that evidence to support a literal view. Now,
well, that's fun stuff.
Oh, my gosh. Don't get me started. I'll take over. You'll also have to start interviewing me. Okay. Well, Phil, ever since I began to believe the claims of the Bible, I have been very focused on the areas where I find doubts. I've been focused on that for many reasons. One of them is that it's not comfortable for me when I have this thing that I say I believe, and then my rational faculty objects, and I experience doubt. And I've grappled with most or all of the tough questions, which there could be hundreds, but a few for our audience, I'll try to put them in the ballpark. How did evil come about if God is perfect and created everything? And if God is entirely loving and omnipotent, why does he allow so much suffering in the world? And how could a God of love espouse the genocide we see in the Old Testament accounts? Now, to stay on this same heavier subject matter that you commented on a minute ago, throughout your spiritual journey, have you had areas of doubt like I have? And what were one or two of them, and have you resolved them?
Well, I had, for me, it was probably a bit more personal in that, you know, growing up, I accepted the Christian faith simply because it was the faith of my parents, and then they passed it on to me.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly after I felt that my parents had really let me down, you know, when mm-hmm. my dad walked off and my mother became very cold and distant, and then she ended up remarrying a man who was a great guy, but I didn't particularly connect with him. So now I had, you know, I was part of a new family that I really didn't buy into. So when my new stepdad wanted to have family devotions, you know, come on, kids, let's have family devotions. In my head, I'm thinking, well, that's if you don't even have a family, how can you have family devotions? You know, what a joke this is. And I could not accept that faith as my parents' faith anymore. And I discovered at that point that I either had to make it my own faith or I had to walk away from it.
Mm.
That there was no more, you know, this is what I grew up with and this is why I believe it. And so I really went into a period of soul searching and reading the Bible and saying, okay, does this make sense to me? Not to my parents, because
sure,
my parents don't make sense to me.
What age, this faith? Phil, you might have said this. What age were you again when this was going on?
17.
Okay.
This would be sophomore, junior, senior year of high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I started reading more, started digging into it more, and I came to the conclusion at that point, you know what, this does make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
This makes more sense than the alternatives. I think every kid, you know, is born believing in God. I think it's just impossible to, you know, to look out your window at everything that's going on and coming to any conclusion other than that somebody made this. You know, this is like the coolest sandbox I've ever seen, and somebody made all this. But then at some point, you know, the idea is introduced as you grow up No, we don't think anybody made it. We think it happened randomly, you know, and it takes a lot of work for a kid to get used to that idea. Okay, no one made this. It happened randomly. And, you know, so as I was growing up and really searching through this, what was clear to me, and I also grew up around lots of missionaries, lots of people of amazing faith who had spent years, you know, following God in the jungles of Africa, in, you know, Irian Jaya, and working with headhunters and cannibals. I had relatives that were the first white people into certain parts of the world, for example.
Wow.
And so I'd always heard these stories that were just miraculous, that were just, you could not explain naturally some of the things that happened to these people. So for me, you know, I didn't have to go searching for the supernatural because I grew up hearing about the supernatural. For me, it was just, okay, am I going to accept this as my own or not? You know, am I going to start living as if I believe this myself? And I decided, yes, I'm going to do that.
Well, let's get back to your story. You say that your love for building things and your passion for animation and making movies led you to start your own business at the ripe old age of 22. And you write, after all, you asked yourself, how hard could it be? Well, how hard was it?
It was extraordinarily hard. It was much harder than I thought. I think I write that, you know, the youthful exuberance that leads you to want to start something, unfortunately, comes with the youthful naivete of being relatively clueless as to how to actually pull it off.
Right.
And so I ran a business, you know, just trying to do commercial work, trying to do art and animation for ad agencies in Chicago for about 3 years, which was extremely hard, primarily because I was just so shy, you know, and that kind of service work is based all on relationships and schmoozing clients and that sort of thing, and I was terrible at it. Mm-hmm. But what I really wanted to do was tell my own stories and infuse my faith into these stories, because I really did not like the fact that even though 80% of Americans, you know, will claim to believe in God and claim to have a Christian heritage, your kids can watch Nickelodeon 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for a year, and they will never see a character who believes in God.
Right.
You know, and the fact that we're trying to raise kids with our faith and with a Christian heritage, and we get absolutely no help whatsoever from Hollywood, really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I set out to do. It took several years of experimentation before I developed the idea.
Yeah, in fact, you say your first animated character was a talking candy bar. And I just wondered if you think you would have had the same success if you'd featured a lot of peanut butter cups and chocolate caramels hopping around.
I think not. I came up with a candy bar primarily because it was simple enough that I could animate him easily. And he was reasonably cute, and it was kind of the first thing that popped into my head. And then my wife, I'd just gotten married, my wife walked by, I was working in our spare bedroom at home, and saw the candy bar and said, you know, moms are going to be mad if you make their kids fall in love with candy bars. And I thought, ooh, good point. Okay, well, what wouldn't moms be mad about their kids falling in love with? And the next thing that popped into my head was a cucumber.
Aha, and the rest was history.
That's how the whole thing started. Yeah, the rest, as they say, was a messy history, but eventually it's...
Yeah. Did you ever see any tangible evidence that God was in what you were trying to do as you started your company?
Absolutely. I really felt from the moment, you know, that I was watching MTV and thought, okay, I know what I'm supposed to do, that God had something for me, you know, and then I thought I had a pretty good sense of what he was asking me to do. So I developed all the techniques, I developed the ideas, I got it all together, I did like a 2-minute test of Larry the Cucumber to show that it worked, and I started showing it around to try to raise the money and get it going, and I got nowhere, and it was just door after door, you know, shut in my face. And at this point, I had a wife, and we just had our first child, and we were starving. I mean,
kinda
we were down,
money.
And finally got, it got so
well,
bad.
Well, you couldn't eat vegetables anymore. Right, and that's the inexpensive
so that
thing.
Out.
Right, you were meat and potatoes, that would be all. Okay,
right.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Right.
Right.
It got so bad that one night I realized we were down to our last $10, that I had done no other commercial work. I had nothing coming in. You know, we were overdrawn in our bank account. We were late on rent. I mean, it was as bad as it could get, and I had a $10 bill in my wallet, and that was it. And right about that time, we just put our daughter down to bed, and my wife pointed out that we were out of dog food. And we had a big dog, and a big bag of Purina was $10. And so I very reluctantly handed her, you know, the last $10 in our world, and she went to the store to buy a bag of dog food. And I sat alone at our dining room table at night, it was fairly dark, just thinking, what a fool am I? You know, I can't feed my daughter, I can't take care of my family, I can't pay my rent, and it's all because I thought God had given me this thing I was supposed to do. And I thought, this was the first time this thought crossed my mind. I thought, what if I'm completely wrong? You know, what if this wasn't God? This was just me. I made this whole thing up, and I am the world's biggest fool.
Perfect place to stop for a break.
Yes.
We will keep our audience hanging.
Yes, and so, there is more to the story.
Yes, there is. No one will leave. No one will change the dial now.
That's right.
So, okay. Well, we are interviewing Phil Vischer, who, among other things, is the creator of VeggieTales. I'm sure that virtually everybody listening to this show knows of VeggieTales. And we are actually hearing Phil's tale of VeggieTales.
From his book, Me, Myself, and Bob.
Very good. Which is his story.
Right.
Yeah. At least so far. He's still a young man, so there will probably be a sequel. I'm sure there will. Okay, but let's take a break.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, and we will be back in a minute.
We live so distracted from the things that matter most. Why is that? In an age glutted with images, we need a refreshed, renewed imagination for God. The premise of Leah Larrington's new book, God's Sight, is simple. If we don't enjoy God as much or more than our other relationships, it's because we don't see Him as He really is. God's Sight invites the reader to imagine God and His kingdom as the Bible describes them. God's Sight is available at Christian and online bookstores, as well as Leah's website, leahlarrington.com.
What do New York City, Los Angeles, and Tomball have in common? Great nightlife. On Main Street, in old downtown Tomball, sits Main Street Crossing, the new hotspot for live music and a complete lineup of evening, entertainment, and gatherings. Monday night, we have Texas Hold'em Poker. On Wednesday night, the high school students take over. Thursday nights, we have young adults from age 18 to 25. And Friday nights, once again, we have Texas Hold'em Poker and live music. Things get really interesting at 4 o'clock and then again at 7. On Sundays, when crowds gather for two events that are sort of like church, but where you can enjoy food, beer, or wine. So you can call it what you like, but it's really a meaningful time. Main Street Crossing, a unique venue for Northwest Houston. 111 Main Street in Old Downtown Tomball, or go to www.mainstreetcrossing.com. We're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And our guest today is Phil Vischer, creator of VeggieTales and author of a book, Me, Myself, and Bob, where he talks about his incredible journey in business, the intense struggle to endure as he tried to build and then witnessed the tremendous fall of a new media empire for God. Okay, Phil, when we took the break, we were talking about you're down to your last $10 that went to feed your hungry, sad-eyed-looking dog, and wondering if it was just your mistake, you know, just that, that your dreams were a fig Newton of your imagination, or
And this was really the first time in 10 years that I began to believe I had it all wrong.
Right.
That God wasn't in this, that I was just making this up all on my own.
And then the question had been, did you ever see any tangible evidence that God was in what you were trying to do?
Yeah, so I wanted to, that thought was so depressing to me that I may have been completely wrong and that God may not have called me to do what I was attempting to do, that I just, to get my mind off it, just started flipping through the mail that was sitting on the table in front of me, a little stack of bills, you know, and it was bill, bill, bill. And then there was an envelope with my name on it and no return address. And I opened it up, and inside was an anonymous cashier's check for $400 written out to me and a note, a handwritten, unsigned note that said, God laid it on my heart that you might need this. And to this day, I have no idea where that came from. You know, but it couldn't have been any clearer to me, you know, than if God had just sat down next to me at the dining room table and said, this isn't you.
You're not crazy.
Yeah. I am
weird,
with you every
but
step
not crazy. He already admitted to being weird, but weird doesn't necessarily mean crazy.
Yeah, and from that point on, we've had other hard times. You know, we were late on payroll multiple times. We're down to our last $10. You know, again, it wouldn't be the last time, and it probably still isn't the last time.
Mm-hmm.
But never since then have I doubted that God had called me to do this, you know, and that I would keep doing it no matter what.
Well, Phil, you discuss, speaking of the business side of things, you discuss in your book the first time that you had a really tantalizing business offer, a deal such that would put your product on the retail shelves in 6,000 outlets, but you had objections to going with this deal for spiritual reasons. Can you discuss this a little bit for our listeners?
Well, we ended up, in fact, a couple in our small group at church ended up putting in the first money to start VeggieTales.
Mm-hmm.
And the husband simply looked at me and said, what you're trying to do is too important to allow not to happen. And he wrote us a check for $80,000 out of his retirement fund. That's what started VeggieTales, because we couldn't get any of the big publishers to give us the time of day.
Yeah.
So I quit my job, produced the first video with just two other guys, working our brains out around the clock for about four straight months to get the first video done. Got it into a few Christian bookstores where it kind of sat around for a while people said vegetables, telling Bible stories, and then went on to the next thing.
Not exactly a hot concept.
No, it actually took about 2 years to really get any traction at all.
Yeah.
But as it was out, some of the secular publishers noticed it, and it was such an innovative thing because it was the first computer animated kids video of any kind. That we had one of them that finally came in and said, you know what, we can put this in 6,000 stores. If you'll just take the Bible verse off the end and remove the references to God, then it'll just be life lessons, and everybody loves a good life lesson. And, we were, again, broke, so it was very, very tempting, but I couldn't help but remember the calling that I felt, and that if it wasn't about God, and if we weren't pointing kids ultimately to the Creator that made them special and loved them very much, I didn't know why I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 6 months later, we had someone else come in and say, all right, just take the Bible verse off, but you can still mention God.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know what, I really want it to be the same message anywhere it goes in the world.
Yeah.
And so finally, about 6 months after that, we found another partner that said, you know what, we'll give it a try, just the way it is.
Yeah.
And so they took it into Walmart and Kmart and Target. They thought they would sell about 300,000 copies in the first year, but everyone was nervous because it was the first thing, kids video that talked about God in it. Instead, they sold almost 2 million copies in the first 12 months.
Yeah.
And it went on to become the number one selling kids video in America. It was on top of the charts for two straight years.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up, they have now sold more than 50 million VeggieTales videos.
And of course,
Warner Brothers' number one kids property.
Yeah,
so
it's
was
an
amazing
series.
Success.
And I missed the window. I mean, I had my young kid before VeggieTales was out.
You did it all wrong.
I know, but I've had just such a fun time going back and get acquainted. And I encourage people that don't have preschoolers to go check it out. It's just too fun. Well, you did experience this meteoric rise that you chronicled in your book, Me, Myself, and Bob, and then you caught this vision. You tell the story of wanting to be the next Walt Disney and the Christian Disney. You tell the story of going to Disney World and wondering, and then walking around in Orlando and wondering, gee, what would it be like if God were in it? There were so many things about Walt Disney that you admired. And yet, in some ways, he was quite frustrating to you. How so?
Well, he was kind of a hopeless modernist. He was something, even near the end of his life in the 60s, people started making fun of him. And it wasn't because, he was dorky or anything. It was because he was still wrapped up in the notion that man could perfect himself at a time in the late 60s when most of the world was bearing great evidence that this was not true.
Mm-hmm.
That more technology did not mean a nobler society or better behavior, that we tended to use our technology first to kill each other before we used it to bless each other. And, you know, so even as he was hanging on to this notion from his childhood, you know, in the beginning of the century, that you know, the more we develop, the more we progress, we can perfect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Just that humanist message that if you just give us enough education, technology, and money, we'll solve all our problems.
That was the general idea, mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, that really starts going back 300 or 400 years with the birth of humanism, saying, mm-hmm. Well, look at the trajectory, you know, from the Dark Ages to where we were in the Renaissance,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
is when the idea was introduced, and let's just extrapolate out. And eventually, man can perfect himself. Well, you know, near the end of the 20th century, all the evidence was pointing to the contrary. And yet Walt was still holding on to, you know, if you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. And so I felt that there had to be a way to take that kind of creativity and the joy that a family has when they experience, you know, his optimism,
mm-hmm.
but reconnect it to the God that made us special and loves us very much, the
mm-hmm.
God that is the only one that can show us how to improve ourselves, and it gives us the only hope, you know, of achieving the nobility that Walt always dreamed about. And I thought, if I could pull those together somehow, man, that would be amazing.
And, of course, you were doing it. I mean, and you were thinking theme parks and all kinds of wonderful future plans.
Yes.
And you had...
Once things really took off,
yeah.
You know, suddenly we went from having no money to suddenly having more money than we knew what to do with.
Well, you wrote... Yeah, you wrote that at the close of 97, you had $4 million in the bank and no debt, and you began... hiring a lot of people to pursue your goal of becoming the Christian Disney that you believed was your destiny.
Yep.
And you believed, as I'm sure I would have, that God was behind your success. And even when your accountant raised these questions about the growth of your expenses, you felt confident that God would not let your company, Big Idea, fall apart. And you write about that at length in your book. It's so interesting. When you look back on that confident outlook now from the vantage point of ultimately having lost your company, how do you evaluate your confident attitude? Do you see it as faith or presumption or something else?
I took God's call and I got it tangled up with my own ambitions. And early success has a great way of expanding your ambition. And I decided I would do as much as I could, as fast as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And that God would bless it all, of course, because he had blessed it initially.
Mm-hmm.
What I stopped thinking about was, you know, am I really listening to God on a daily basis? Or have I just headed off in a general direction and now I'm going so fast and, you know, everything is so loud and so noisy that I've lost the ability to listen entirely. I was chasing my own ambition more than God's call by the end. Thought I was doing what he wanted me to do, but I wasn't taking the time to even listen. And so by
what
the
do you
end
mean,
of,
what do you mean by that, Phil? You weren't taking the time to listen.
Well, it all started out with me being in a quiet enough place that I could watch MTV and hear God whisper to me, "That's what I want you to do. I want you to do something about that." You know, and then once I got going, and it's just as simple as, you know, right now I spend about a half an hour every morning just reading the Bible and praying and getting off by myself and being quiet. Because if you can't be quiet, you can't hear God. I mean, God whispers. He seldom shouts. You know, every now and then he'll show up in a burning bush or in a really loud wind. But for the most part, people, if you talk to a 90-year-old, you know, missionary or someone who's traveled the whole world doing what God has called them to do, they talk about the still, small voice, the little whisper of, you know, here's what I have for you next. And you have to actually be quiet to hear that. And I lost it. I completely lost the ability to just calm myself down and be quiet enough to hear, you know, okay, God, am I still on track? Am I still doing what you asked me to do? As a result, I hired too many people. I spent too much money. I had 200 people on staff by the end of the year 2000, thinking, you know, hey, I am the chosen one. Everything that I think of will work. And found out that was not the case and ended up having to lay off about 150 of my best friends. It was just brutal, just about broke my heart. And I couldn't understand why God would allow it to fall apart. Ended up sitting in the back row of a bankruptcy courtroom in downtown Chicago and watched everything that I had built get packed up in a box and sold to the highest bidder at a public auction.
In fact, you write that the hardest part of your bankruptcy was asking that question, what kind of God would stand back and watch a dream, a good dream for ministry and impact, fall apart? And that this is one of those questions you were shouting at God, and you write that he did begin to whisper an answer. And this is another point where we're not ready to take a break, but I can just picture our audience turning up their radios and leaning in like the folks on an E.F. Hutton commercial. So what did he say?
I started to look back, and he showed me what I had done. He showed me how miserable I had become because I was working so hard and striving so much that it was affecting my health, it was affecting my marriage, it was affecting my kids, my employees, everyone around me. Everything was becoming more and more chaotic because I was striving so manically to go so fast. Mm-hmm. And I was miserable, and I realized that I was pushing a rock up a mountain that he never asked me to push. That it wasn't about how big we got or how many people I had on staff or how much good we did. It was simply, are you doing today what I asked you to do today? You know, which has as much to do with how I treat the girl who's bagging my groceries at the grocery store as it does with my huge effort to impact the entire world. I was becoming useless to the people around me and to the God that I was trying to follow, because I was so busy and so driven, and I was miserable, and I realized that he let it all fall apart, not because he didn't love me, but because he loved me so much, and he wanted me to restore me to a life that was filled with, Paul in the Bible writes, that if you are following God, if you are doing what he asks, and doing it with his spirit in you, your life will be marked with peace, joy, love, kindness, patience, long-suffering. I mean, the most wonderful-sounding things you can imagine will be coming out of your life. And I realized, okay, my life is marked with stress, anxiety, concern, insomnia.
Franticness.
Yes, something is completely wrong. And I realized it was because I was making impact my God. What I could do for the world.
No, what do you mean? Wait, what do you mean by that? Impact your God.
The impact, how much good I could do, had become the most important thing to me, rather than making God the most important thing to me.
And what do you see is the difference? I mean, somebody's out there saying, I don't understand what you mean by that. What is the difference?
I summed it up in my book like this. The impact that God has planned for me doesn't occur when I'm pursuing impact. It occurs when I'm pursuing God. In other words, if my focus is on my relationship with the Creator of the universe, who loves me just infinitely, if my focus is on Him, I will have exactly the amount of impact that He wants me to have. If my focus is on the impact I want, I get paranoid, I get stressed, I get cranky, and my life ceases to exhibit the love, the peace, the joy that is really what he created me to be. So focusing on impact is really ultimately a recipe for stress. It's why Americans are so stressed, because we're trying to figure out if we're accomplishing more than the people next to us.
Right.
Well, God doesn't care if you're accomplishing more than the guy next to you. He cares if you're doing exactly what he asked you to do today, which has more to do with loving the people around you than it does with changing the world and doing something big and impressive. So I really have an entirely new life now. I'm still working on ideas that could change the world, but whether or not they change the world, I've realized, is none of my business. It's God's business. My business is, what has he called me to do today, and am I doing it? And if I'm focused on him, my life will overflow with love, not stress.
Wow. That sounds so right to me. I'm a little older than you, Phil. I had some early success, financial success like you did. And I can remember the day when I decided it was my job to make and give away $1 billion in my lifetime.
Oh, well, good heavens.
As the years have progressed, that goal is looking more and more unlikely. And now, actually, it's kind of embarrassing. So I can't believe I'm saying this on the air, because it just seems so arrogant and just
right. I even look back at the name I picked for my company. It was Big Idea Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And think, ooh, doesn't that just smell a little prideful?
Yeah, well, you know what?
My ideas are the biggest.
Okay. Well, guess what? I'd love to keep talking about that. Two embattled business guys, both with some scars and some stories to tell where we got them. But we are out of time. And we thank you very much for being – I know. Well,
that's too bad.
Maybe – well, this is your second time on. So you'll probably be back, I'm sure. And perhaps we'll strike up a friendship off the air. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to our audience about your story and your faith experience. And I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Phil.
You're welcome. It's been great to be here.
Okay, Phil, well, thank you very much. We'll talk soon.
All right, thank you.
We've been interviewing Phil Vischer, creator of The VeggieTales, on his new book, Me, Myself, and Bob, in anticipation of their new movie, The VeggieTales' new movie, coming out in January. And this is Lael Arrington.
And Rick Davis.
On The Things That Matter Most. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. We're always interested in making our show better, and you, our listeners, can play a role. We'd like your feedback on what you like about our show and what you think can be better. You can give us your insights by going to thethingsthatmattermost.org or by sending us an email at info@thethingsthatmattermost.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
Homemade Houston, a Greater Houston Builders Association nonprofit organization, partners with local housing industry leaders who donate time and money to construct dignified housing for homeless families and individuals. Homemade Houston is a chapter of Homemade America, the nation's largest provider of transitional housing for the temporarily homeless. Please join us as we take this step toward rebuilding lives and eliminating homelessness in Houston. Visit us online at homeaidhouston.org.
We're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we've been interviewing the creator of VeggieTales, Phil Vischer, and his book, Me, Myself, and Bob, that tells the true story about dreams, God, and talking vegetables, and really his struggle to create this great media empire for God, and then watching it all slip through his fingers. And the evidence for God that he found on his journey. You know, Rick, so often we are looking at why we believe what we believe and talking to all these different people, and often we're talking about the sciences, how our beliefs square with biology or physics or archaeology or textual criticism, how reliable are certain...
Fulfilled prophecy.
Yeah, are certain books that claim that God speaks through them. But there is this other line of evidence that comes from our own experience where we believe what we believe because we've experienced God in a really real way in our lives. And, of course, that is Phil's story. What was your response? What's your take?
Well, a very personal response. I will tell you one place that I really connect with Phil and a little bit intertwining it with my journey. I'm telling you, Lael, there is nothing on this earth that could fill me with like the kind of purpose that Phil has always felt.
Mm-hmm.
I relate because it transcends to him transcended time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no amount of money, nothing on this earth that I can imagine, and I know people do it, and maybe I would if I didn't believe what I do. But where I am today on the other side of faith, I cannot imagine going through what I've been through in my business life unless I had a purpose other than just things here in time and space. Well, that wraps up another show, and we're all getting ready to go into another busy week, and there are lots of things to keep us fully occupied, but it's the kinds of questions that we ask on this show that in the end are going to be the most important. So this week, don't get so busy that you don't take time to think about the things that matter most.